is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington.
We stood on the roof for like 12 hours in the rain, holding or just clenching, holding on to each other in nothing but night clothes. And we thought the wind was going to knock us in the water.
What has happened down here?
I estimate 2,000 people living like animals inside the city convention center and around it. There's no food, there's absolutely no water, and there are two dead bodies lying on the ground and in a wheelchair beside the convention center. People are absolutely desperate there. I've never seen anything like this.
6 feet of water in the streets of Evangeline.
They got gas lines everywhere spewing out, and people walking around with cigarettes. Just start a fire and everything's gonna burn.
Matt Lee, a resident, says he's been walking around for 12 hours in the all but vacant streets.
These huge casinos uprooted, you know, straight out of the water and put in the middle of the highway.
And Brownie, you're doing a heck of a job. The FEMA director's working 24.
George Bush doesn't care about black people.
And I don't care what people are saying uptown or wherever they are. This city will be chocolate at the end of the day.
It's been 15 years since Hurricane Katrina wreaked havoc along the United States Gulf Coast. Today, another hurricane, Hurricane Laura, tore over the coast. The storm made landfall early this morning as a Category 4 hurricane. It was then downgraded to a Category 2. What we know about Laura's impact is changing fast. At least one person has died. For the very latest, stick with your NPR station and follow updates at npr.org. As we look back on Katrina 15 years later and watch Laura today, what lessons have we learned for future disasters? Later on the show, we'll shine a light on how far the city of New Orleans has come with former Mayor Mitch Landrieu and actor and longtime New Orleans resident Harry Shearer. But first, let's welcome Andy Horowitz. He's an assistant professor of history at Tulane University and author of Katrina, A History, 1915 to 2015. Andy, welcome to 1A.
Thank you for having me.
And also with us is Sandy Rosenthal. She's the founder of Levees.org, and her new book is called Words Whispered in Water, Why the Levees Broke in Hurricane Katrina. Sandy, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Andy, can you kick us off by updating us on the latest with this new storm? Where is Hurricane Laura right now?
Last I checked, it's somewhere not too far north of Lake Charles in the southwestern part of Louisiana.
What do things look like on the ground right now? Are there particular areas you're really worried about?
Well, I've only seen the news reports from Lake Charles. I'm thankfully quite far from there, but I know Cameron Parish, I know Calcasieu Parish a little bit, and there's just nowhere that is well equipped to stand up to a storm of this size and this magnitude. So at this point, I'm just hoping that there were not too many people there to see it.
Well, and Andy, this has been a hyperactive hurricane season. It's the first hurricane season on record in which 9 tropical storms formed before August and 13 formed before September. What's to account for the hyperactivity?
Well, you know, there have always been storms. There have always been large hurricanes in the Gulf Coast. But the reason that there are more storms and the reason that they are stronger and accelerating much more quickly is a product of the climate crisis. And there's a certain, you know, perverse irony to the fact that this storm made landfall at one of the epicenters of the American oil industry there around Lake Charles, a place that is just full of various kinds of petrochemical refineries that don't always have a great safety record when it comes to protecting the people around them from environmental toxins. So I hope that they make it through this intact without doing any further damage.
Sandy, did you want to jump in here?
I did want to embellish a bit what Andy had said. What was very disturbing about Hurricane Laura was its sudden change in direction and sudden strengthening within 24 hours. That was very scary. And also it was a very much a deja vu because that is what Hurricane Katrina did 15 years ago. There is not a single person in this city that has forgotten that we all thought Katrina was going to hit the Florida Panhandle 2 days before it hit. And then we all got worried would know all the models have shifted, all of them suddenly, and now the storm was heading for New Orleans. And I was actually in New York City and had to fly home, board up my house, and then get back out of town. But this sudden strengthening and shifting within 24 hours is very, very frightening.
You were living in New Orleans with your husband and your 15-year-old son at the time. How were your neighbors responding to the storm? Were they also trying to evacuate?
Oh, yes, indeed. The very few people stayed. Our neighbors, we basically, they were elderly, and elderly folks can be stubborn. And we convinced them that they needed to leave because there might not be any medical help in case the trees were down. But I'm glad you mentioned that, because many people stayed in New Orleans to be with their pets. At that time, FEMA refused to take pets for evacuation. And a lot of people stayed with their pets and quite horribly perished with their pets. So since then, FEMA has changed their evacuation rules and now must accommodate families with pets. And this is not done for the pets, but done for the safety of the families.
Well, Tracy wrote on Facebook, lesson, all disasters are local. Prepare ahead of time. Evacuate when advised to. But Andy, evacuation can be complicated for people if they don't have the income to move quickly, or they don't necessarily have a place to go. Explain that a little bit more and how it played out in Katrina.
Yeah, you know, the estimate is that something on the order of 130,000 people remained in New Orleans when Katrina hit and the levees collapsed. And that is roughly the same number of New Orleanians who didn't have access to private transportation. So sometimes we think about people being, you know, stubborn to leave or having some sort of personal circumstance that prevents them. But it is also the case that being able to get out of town on short notice, having somewhere to go, paying for a hotel, paying for the gas, paying for the car, we don't think often enough about how the government has subsidized a huge evacuation infrastructure for people with cars. We've spent all this money to build roads, but the public transportation systems are comparatively much weaker and simply failed people in advance of Katrina and left many people unable to leave.
Well, Sandy, Hurricane Katrina, meaning the actual storm itself, was a natural disaster, but the impact of the storm, the flooding, the human suffering was man-made, and you uncover that in your book, Whispered Words in Water. Tell us about the levees.
Yes, I'd be happy to do that. And I want to tack on one embellishment to what Andy said about the preparation. Actually, the evacuation for Hurricane Katrina was the most successful rapid evacuation in the history of the country. However, way too little attention was paid to people without a car, credit cards, road experience, and people out of town. But with that real quick, yes, I'm happy to talk about the levees. The reason that I wrote my book is because after Katrina, the people of this great city of New Orleans were characterized as irresponsible and a burden on the nation just for the fact that they lived in the city of New Orleans when the levees broke. I felt that it was important to write my book and put it out there that the flooding of New Orleans was caused by mistakes in the levees, design and construction mistakes in the levees that were built by the Army Corps of Engineers. And if that were not enough, the Army Corps also spent millions fooling the American public and Congress on whose fault the levee breaches belonged to, and harassed anyone who stood up to them. So I felt that the people of this great city deserved for the real information to be out there in front of the American people, and that's why I wrote my book.
Very quickly, was there one moment during your investigation where you realized most of this could have been prevented?
Well, yes. 4 weeks after the flooding, now keep in mind, I didn't flood, my son's school didn't flood, and I had the luxury of being able to read and listen to news reports. 4 weeks after the flood, the Government Accountability Office turned in a report in a hearing that explained very clearly that the Army Corps of Engineers, the federal government, is responsible for design and construction of the levees, and the local interests do the maintenance. Well, that means that if the levees break, you need to look at the designer, the architect, and the contractor. And that, all three of those, is the Army Corps of Engineers. And for me, that's when a light went off.
That's founder of levees.org, Sandy Rosenthal. And we're also talking to Tulane University Associate Professor Andy Horowitz about the very active hurricane season. And we're looking back to find out what we can learn from the devastation brought on by Hurricane Katrina 15 years ago. We're also talking to you. John in California emails, "These storms and fires are unnatural. We bring them on with the climate crisis, and the only way to protect ourselves is to arrest the climate crisis." I'm Jen White. More from our guests and from you in just a moment. This is 1A.
This message comes from NPR sponsor BetterHelp. BetterHelp offers licensed professional counselors who specialize in issues such as isolation, depression, stress, anxiety, and more. Connect with your professional counselor in a safe and private online environment when you need professional help. Get help at your own time and your own pace. Schedule secure video or phone sessions, plus chat and text with your therapist. Visit betterhelp.com/1A to learn more and get 10% off your first month.
Do you talk about the news with your friends, your family, or maybe perfect strangers? You can get all the facts you need to be up to speed on this busy news cycle on the 1A News Roundup. Find the podcast in your feed every Friday.
How was it that the richest and most powerful country in the world was laid low by a virus only microns in size? One science journalist says, it's the inequities that have been with us for generations that made our body politic such opportunistic targets. Listen to the Code Switch podcast from NPR.
I'm Jen White. We're using this hour to mark the 15th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina as another hurricane sweeps across the Gulf Coast. My guests are the founder of levees.org, Sandy Rosenthal, and Tulane University Associate Professor Andy Horowitz. Sandy, when people think of the flooding after Hurricane Katrina, they think of the levees being breached. But you talk about a lesser-known infrastructure failure that led to the flooding in eastern New Orleans, the Gulf Intercoastal Waterway. What is that?
Certainly. In eastern New Orleans, levees are built along what's called the Gulf Intercoastal Waterway. Those levees were built during World War II. When Hurricane Katrina's surge arrived and flowed over the banks of the levees along eastern New Orleans, they literally melted. They melted in 5 or 6 different locations. So what happened is, instead of those levees being filled with good, thick Louisiana clay, they were filled with sand and erodible materials. So somebody was looking the other way when those levees were being built. Somebody cut costs, and somebody made money building those levees on the cheap. And when they melted, the entire eastern New Orleans was flooded and devastated in areas as deep as 10 feet. And that's a rather little-known fact that should be made more available, and I definitely do discuss that in my book. Hmm.
And Andy, your book is called Katrina, A History, 1915 to 2015. Why does the history of Hurricane Katrina span this 100-year period?
The reason I start the book in 1915 is that there was an enormous hurricane that made landfall in Louisiana then. It was probably the most powerful hurricane to make landfall in Louisiana until Laura. And it arrived in 1915 just as the city had finished construction on what was then a state-of-the-art massive drainage system. For the 200 years the city had been in existence until 1915, people generally lived on the high ground right near the Mississippi River, and the rest of the city was basically uninhabitable. When the storm came in 1915, it did cause some flooding. Some people died, but basically engineers and city planners believed that the city had passed a defining test. The headline in the newspaper the next day was, "The record shows that New Orleans is stormproof, that its drainage system works." And so the city began to expand into lower-lying areas. If you fast forward to 2005 and trace the outline of the flood that occurred when those levees collapsed, what's left around that tracing is the city as it stood in 1915. So it wasn't, as many people imagine, you know, exclusively black New Orleans rather than white New Orleans. It wasn't poor New Orleans rather than rich New Orleans. It was 20th century New Orleans that flooded. And that showed me that to make sense of the Katrina disaster, I really had to understand the 20th century history of New Orleans.
When you think of what's happening right now, I mean, Hurricane Laura is still happening. And after studying Katrina for so long, what potential red flags do you see in this moment that could get in the way of recovery?
One of the things that Katrina's history teaches is that the water itself often has a much smaller impact on the long-term outcomes for people in the face of a disaster. So even though the flood in 2005 washed over the homes of many white people, many wealthy people, they disproportionately were able to return to the city while poor people and black people were not. Today in New Orleans, the population is down from 2005, around 8,000 white people, but around 92,000 black people. And that is a result much more of policy decisions made after the flood than of the flood itself. So as I watch Laura, I'm aware that while we're sort of fixated by the spectacle of the wind and rain and water, we need to be very attendant to the sort of policies that we put in place and who those policies are designed to help and who they will not reach.
Well, and give us an example of a specific policy that made it more difficult for the city's poorer residents to rebuild.
Well, a very clear one is the case of public housing in New Orleans. There were several thousand units of public housing that were inhabited in 2005. Those people who were almost exclusively black had to evacuate, as everybody did, after the flood. And they were never allowed to come home, even though those homes were either not damaged at all or could have been easily rehabbed. The city and the federal government, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, used this as an opportunity to realize a long-standing plan to demolish all public housing in New Orleans. So that's an example of people, black people, who were simply dispossessed of their homes as a, you know, as part of what is called the Katrina recovery.
Well, Deborah emails, let's be clear, the people affected by Katrina are still suffering. It's deplorable that these people were treated like they didn't exist by a country who claims to care about its people. God help them as Laura hits them yet again 15 years later. You know, Sandy, so many of the inequities that we saw after Hurricane Katrina were some of the same inequities we saw 40 years prior after Hurricane Betsy in 1965. Now we have Hurricane Laura. What are you watching for? Are you expecting to see some of the same dynamics play out today?
I am expecting, because contrary to what most people think, levees are not a New Orleans phenomenon. 62% of the American population lives in counties that are protected by levees. That's nearly two-thirds of the American population lives by levees. And they, what happened to us could happen to them, especially since they're built by people. So, yes, I watch this and with a lot of concern, especially since the coastal Texas and coastal Louisiana is our counties protected by levees. If anyone would like to see a map of those counties, there is a map up on the home page of my organization's website, levees.org. So yes, I'm very, very watchful of what's going on right now.
Ron writes on Facebook, I was deployed to both Katrina and Rita as a coordinator of hundreds of utility workers restoring power to the areas. The dead animals, upended burial vaults, ships and houses displaced by the storm surge was something to remember. I've been deployed to many other storms, floods, tornadoes, etc. across the U.S., but my experience in Cameron Parish with Rita was the worst widespread damage I witnessed in a 35-year disaster response career. Ron, thanks for that message. Sandy, President George W. Bush's response to Hurricane Katrina has been widely criticized. How would you compare his handling of that disaster to the way the federal government is handling a disaster that affects the whole country, the coronavirus pandemic?
Well, that story is still going on. You know, that history is happening now. Certainly, 15 years ago, as I watched the flooding disaster unfold, I was able also to watch the failed response. And it is unequivocally, there is no contest. It is universally agreed upon that the response to Hurricane Katrina and the response to the flooding was inadequate. It was a failed response. Now, with coronavirus, the history is happening. And to say that the government has failed at this point is premature because it's still happening. That said, I do feel like this is a deja vu because this time, because I'm married to a numbers guy, guy. And my husband, numbers guy, both 15 years ago and during coronavirus, saw these events coming and told me to prepare. 15 years ago, I packed for 3 weeks, and that put me in a relatively secure place to watch the disaster unfold and then watch the response. Fast forward to now, while everyone else was at Mardi Gras, I was at Costco buying towel paper and medicine and stocking up. So again, here I was in a relatively secure place watching the disaster unfold and then watching the government respond. But again, it's a little bit too soon to judge the government on whether it's failed or not since it's still going on.
Well, Andy, we're all still dealing with coronavirus. Meanwhile, there are other disasters, natural disasters, hitting several parts of the country pretty hard. The wildfires in California, two hurricanes hitting the Gulf Coast this week. What do you think the Trump administration has learned from the pandemic that could help us with disaster preparedness going forward?
Nothing. Mm. My perspective is a little different from Sandy's. I survey these hundreds of thousands of people who have died, preventable deaths, the economic collapse that we're in the throes of, the just suffering that is endemic across the country, and I just see a horrific failure that, you know, even if everything magically started going right from now, this would be a period of great shame and terror in U.S. history. And, you know, the part that resonates with me from what Sandy said is that I do think that New Orleanians greet this moment with something with less surprise, perhaps, than others did. There was a instinct in 2005 to see Katrina as something that could only happen sort of out in one exceptional exotic city, you know, sort of on the margins of American life. But now, as we go through that dystopian litany that you just offered, fire, pandemic, floods everywhere, Katrina seems much less like an isolated incident or some exception than, you know, terrifying to say, kind of a harbinger for what 21st century America is.
My guests have been Andy Horowitz. He's an assistant professor of history at Tulane University and author of Katrina, A History, 1915 to 2015. And Sandy Rosenthal. She's the founder of Levees.org, and her new book is called Words Whispered in Water, Why the Levees Broke in Hurricane Katrina. Thanks to you both. Coming up, it took a while, but New Orleans did rebuild. What does the Big Easy look like today? I'm Jen White. This is 1A.
Actor Billy Porter lived through the HIV/AIDS crisis in the 80s, and he says the words of wisdom he learned back then could help with the times we're living through right now.
Love always wins. Mm. Love always wins. Mm. That's it.
Poe star Billy Porter on love, race, church, and an Emmy nomination. Listen now to the It's Been a Minute podcast from NPR.
Now let's get back to our commemoration of the 15th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. Joining me now is former New Orleans Mayor Mitch Landrieu. He served as mayor from 2010 to 2018. He's also author of In the Shadow of Statues, A White Southerner Confronts History. Mayor Landrieu, welcome back to 1A.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
And also with us is actor and comedian Harry Shearer. Shearer is a longtime resident of New Orleans and creator of The Big Uneasy, a 2010 documentary on the fault of the Army Corps of Engineers during Hurricane Katrina. Harry, thanks for being here today.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
So, Mayor Landrieu, you became mayor in 2010 while the city was very much still in recovery mode. What was your biggest mission going in?
I was a lieutenant governor of the state when Katrina hit. New Orleans had a hard time getting its feet underneath it for a couple of years. But when I took office, we had already had Katrina, Rita, Ike, Gustav, the national recession. We had just suffered the BP oil spill. The city was on the verge of bankruptcy, and not a whole lot of rebuilding had actually gotten done. Miraculously, though, I mean, everybody in the city started pulling in the same direction. And we just started rebuilding the city. But, you know, the idea was not to put it back like it was. It was to try to figure out what had been broken, why it was broken, what was structurally wrong with it, and then trying to do a deep dive with very limited resources, very limited time, very limited patience, and how to structurally rebuild the city so that it could survive for a very long period of time. You know, what people forget about Katrina is that it was not a weather disaster as big as that storm was. It was a man-made engineering failure. And that is one of the things that we have to continue to concentrate on as we go forward.
Well, Harry, you created a documentary, The Big Uneasy, about the Army Corps of Engineers' responsibilities to the city of New Orleans. Do you think they've made the necessary changes to see something like this doesn't happen again?
I don't think the basic view of the Army Corps and how it views its mission has changed. No, it's important to remember not one individual at the Army Corps of Engineers lost so much as a parking space for being involved in the near destruction of a major American and world treasure city. They just went to Congress, got $14 billion, and got told, do it better this time. I think what they failed to learn, and I don't think they're equipped to learn, is that there is another way to deal with all these problems than to engage in what they envision as their mission, a war on water. When I came to New Orleans, there were all these structures. You never saw what they were. They were the walls of these three outfall canals. The Army Corps decided to hide them from view. Normally, in cities, the view of water is a good thing. It adds to property values. But they were conducting a war, and so that was their view of the situation. Early after the flooding, a local architect in New Orleans began conducting something called the Dutch Dialogues, bringing Dutch engineers and Dutch city planners to help us learn the lessons they had already learned, that you can't win a war on water. You have to build a modern city to learn to live with water, enjoy its features during the good times, have it be able to drain successfully and not flood up during the bad times. There is a little test project in the Gentilly neighborhood of New Orleans, which is trying to put into practice some of those tenets of the new Dutch way of dealing with water. And we were watching that experiment. Would that it had taken root in more of the city than it already has. But the Corps followed its old practice of trying to conduct a war on water in building the new system, and there are little problems with the new system as well. I want to say, though, that the thing that I found most moving about the recovery was the fact that it wasn't, you know, there were talks early on about big plans. The former mayor, the mayor that preceded Mayor Landrieu, was talking about building a whole new row of casinos in the middle of the city. What happened, in fact, was every single person who came back used their own resources, what few resources they could get from the government, in the case of road home payments to rebuild their own home, and rebuild their own businesses one at a time. It was a grassroots recovery built by the people who loved the city enough to engage in it.
Mayor Landrieu, what's the main thing you want to see from the federal government now when it comes to disaster aid in Louisiana, especially since another hurricane has hit the coast?
A couple things. First of all, you can, if you just take a minute and breathe in this moment that's hard to breathe in, and you take a historical view or a 40,000-foot view, you notice that we've not responded well to a pandemic, which we should have foreseen and should have been prepared for. That we knew that there was going to be a hurricane season coming. We knew when the pandemic started. We are seeing a racial reckoning that has been a long time in coming. One of the things we have to do in this country is think about the design of the country and how things got where they are. Our tendency is to say immediately after the storm, you know, how did everybody get there? Well, the idea of building back the way it was supposed to be, if we would have gotten it right the first time, forces you to do a very, very deep dive and to look at yourself and say, you know, where were our mistakes? Now, Harry, who's been a great and wonderful citizen and advocate in New Orleans, and Harry, thank you for all your work, basically said that from the New Orleans' inception and the country's desire to have New Orleans provide economic growth and development because of its proximity to the river has had a philosophy of living, which is to keep the water out. Our entire sewage and drainage and water system is designed with big pumps to push the water out. The Dutch have taught us how maybe that's upside down. Maybe what you need to do is let the water in. So massive system redesigns like that take a lot of time, a lot of money, a lot of courage. The same thing is true about how we grow our indigenous cultures. The New Orleans is in many, so many ways the soul of America. And in order for everything to work well, or when it can work well, both the federal, state, and local governments, in partnership with community organizations and small businesses and individuals and churches, have to all come together and put their resources in a focused and thoughtful way in a design that actually produces a good result. That's the 40,000-foot view. Basically, right now, the federal government has been absent. This idea that somehow poor cities like New Orleans, and there are many others, can somehow take care of themselves when a massive storm like Laura hits is just insane. It's just not so. And so I'm thankful for what the federal government did in terms of getting resources down here post-Katrina, but they were late. It took too long. It wasn't enough. The Category 3 levees, which are much better than they were before, should have been built to what we call Category 5 strength, or better yet, 500-year flood protection rather than 100-year flood protection. So I just think the federal government has the tools to do bigger and better things if it can be rightly focused and rightly resourced. You cannot leave communities on their own. You're going to see this with the wildfires in California. You're going to see it. You saw it with Sandy on the East Coast. You saw it with Maria some years ago. You saw it in Houston. And these things are going to continue to happen. The final piece is with sea level rise, with climate change, and with subsidence, all of these areas are going to become more vulnerable. And we have to really be thoughtful about how we're going to protect ourselves going forward. And that's
That brings me to a question from Kokomo Kid, who asks on Twitter, should the low parts of New Orleans and some other cities be permanently depopulated? Your thoughts?
I think that sounds so easy to do. But, you know, when you actually think about the reality of it and that the human beings that are there and how many people are there, it gets to be almost near impossible. That is not to say that when you build back, you don't build back stronger and better. I think that if you came and saw some of the construction in New Orleans now with people building higher and building stronger. And having said that, it is also true that New Orleans isn't even near to being the most vulnerable city in America. And that question doesn't get asked very much of other cities. So I think we have to be smart about what we do. I think the design has to be smart. But essentially, you can't build back just the structures and not build the soul of a community, which is investments in its people. And that's what the long-term challenge is going to be, not only for New Orleans, but for the rest of the country.
Harry, you moved to New Orleans, and you certainly have the means to relocate. But what keeps you in the city?
Love. I moved to the city because I fell in love with the city. It is a very alluring place. It has a unique indigenous culture that is often imitated, but there's nothing like the real thing. And aside from the food and the music and the architecture, the everyday life lived there, the fact that people talk to other people, whether they're strangers or friends, there is a vibe in the community, and it's true across races. Even though there are deep racial divides in the city, you find yourself talking to all sorts of people and all sorts of people talking to you. And that just makes, in my experience, for a far more enjoyable day-to-day experience. I want to follow one thing that the mayor said and that your listener said. One of the things we had to deal with during the recovery was the attitude in Washington. Those people down there, they're fools for living there. We shouldn't be putting good money after bad. Most notably, the former Speaker of the House, Denny Hastert, was saying, why would you want to those people should all move. So the aid that we got from the federal government was filtered through this filter of, we really shouldn't be doing this in the first place. By the way, Denny Hastert is now in jail.
Mayor Landrieu, as Hurricane Laura moves across the Gulf Coast, how are things looking in New Orleans right now?
Well, we don't know yet. I mean, the sun's just coming up. Last night, that storm hit about 1 o'clock. It came in as a Category 4. I expect there to be tremendous damage. At 5 o'clock this morning, there was still 105-mile-per-hour winds heading up to North Louisiana past Alexandria and Shreveport. The governor has said that he's deployed all of the National Guard, and we have firefighters and EMS and wildlife and fisheries and all kinds of folks out there trying to rescue people and get to people that have been in harm's way. So my sense is that today is going to be a very, very difficult day in terms of search and rescue. But the damage is going to be extensive, and this is going to be with us a long time, on top of the fact that electricity will be out longer than we anticipated because of the damage, and all these first responders are responding in the midst of the COVID crisis. And so we have a lot of challenges, a lot of pain, you know, and we're just going to have to deal with it as best we can.
That's Mitch Landrieu. He's the former mayor of New Orleans and author of In the Shadows of Statues, A White Southerner Confronts History. Also with us, Harry Shearer, an actor and longtime resident of New Orleans. He's also the creator of the 2010 documentary, The Big Uneasy. His new satirical album, The Many Moods of Donald Trump, is available now. Thanks to you both for joining us. Today's producer was Sharla Freeland. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and let's talk again tomorrow. This is 1A.